The Spinoff Podcast Network. Skinny are helping you show how smart you are with the 1Q Quiz, an all-new, super challenging and super quick daily quiz built by The Spinoff. Every Monday, Skinny are giving you the chance to prove you're smart with the Skinny Extra Credit question. Get it right, and you'll get the chance to score yourself some Skinny Extra mobile credit so you can text, call, or even video call your group chat and gloat about how big your brain is. T's and C's apply.
The Fold is brought to you by oOh!media, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa. Nau mai, hoki mai, kia The Fold e mihi nei. Ko Duncan Grieve tōku ingoa. My guest today is Guyon Espinner, who is an investigative journalist at RNZ, also very often a co-host of Morning Report, which is a show that he hosted for some years. And I always feel like the product is a little bit more electric when he's around it. He's on The Fold this week because of a series that he has just completed called Mate, Comrade, Brother, which are all sort of verbatim quotes from communications between lobbyists and ministerial advisors or people in government agencies. And, you know, it's been a series which, as soon as it was announced, as soon as the first reporting came out, I was like, this is fantastic. It's classic Guyon to kind of go really deep into an issue around the relationship between government and the sort of population at large, where, you know, I think, and he makes the case that the public interest is not being served, even though we are sort of paying for all this information or all these interactions to occur. And, you know, I need to be upfront. Guyon's one of my favourite journalists in this country. I've followed his career since he was the political editor of the Sunday Star Times. I remember reading his columns and thinking, this is a really different tone and approach to the subject of political commentary. He went from there to TVNZ, was political editor, hosted Q&A, moved to Three, which oftentimes the direction of traffic can feel like it goes from Three to TVNZ. It's interesting that he went the other way. Did a show called The Vote, which is probably just a footnote to his career, really, but one that I really loved, and we talk about that. And then ultimately has moved to RNZ, where he's still now firstly hosting Morning Report and then moving into this. You know, he was one of the first people to go into these kind of more at-large roles that you now see Paddy Gower in. We've got our own in a way, and Toby Manhire. John Campbell's doing a similar thing at TVNZ. But, you know, that's the beauty of those kind of having a really senior journalist who's got a bit more time on their hands. So he's basically, every so often, he will just kind of parachute in with a new series, a new project. You know, he's made these documentaries about alcohol and drugs and Proof and Wasted. He did The Ninth Floor, which we discuss in depth, interviews with former prime ministers. Basically, he's, I think, a very industrious original journalist, and it's just was a real privilege to sit down with him for an hour and have him really explore, you know, his career, the different aspects of the media organisations that he's worked for, and how all this stuff has evolved and is evolving. So yeah, there is some merger chat in there. I make no apologies for that, to give a politician's answer. So yeah, this is a good one. This is Guyon Espinner, an investigative journalist at RNZ, on The Fold. Tēnā koe, Guyon, and thank you so much for coming on The Fold this week.
Kia ora.
So I want to start with the reporting that you've been doing this week. Mate, Comrade, Brother is the sort of series overarching name. What is the name in reference to, and what is the sort of function? What are you trying to convey with this series?
Well, the name is from the tone and some direct quotes from the text messages and signal messages and emails. We filed more than 70 OAA requests to get this material and got thousands of communications. One of the things that strikes you as you go through it is the intimacy. the relationships that these lobbyists have, particularly with ministerial advisors. And I find this really interesting because what they're doing is they're targeting advisors and ministerial officers. Remember, those people don't have any pecuniary interest register. You're never going to find out what their relationships are. And they are inviting them out for drinks and dinner and getting really close to them and then getting information out of them, often for quite significant policy. And in a way that is utterly transparent. We have no idea that that's going on. And we have no idea who the client lists are for most of these lobbying firms because there's no regulation around it in New Zealand. So the title came from the direct quotes, you know, hey mate, hey comrade, do you want to catch up for a beer and talk about gambling? I mean, you know, it's stuff that I haven't seen before. We've known that this lobbying industry is quite strong and has been growing, but we very rarely get a glimpse. And to be honest, and to, you know, to acknowledge its own shortcomings, this is still just a glimpse because we don't know what happened at those meetings. Much of the material is redacted, but it's more than I've seen about how this industry operates.
So, I mean, what do you think the motive is for the, like, you understand why the corporation, I mean, you're actually looking at it quite narrowly in some respects, largely through the lens of what government is spending, because that's what's easily accessible through the IIA. Probably the much bigger partners are corporate affairs. You understand what their motives are, and some of them are actually fully legitimate, like legislation impacts them and so on. But on the ministerial advisor side, it's somewhat mysterious about why, beyond, you know, a free meal and a beer is nice, but it's not so nice that you'd kind of do something that was contra the public interest, you'd think. From your reading of these reams of communications, is it the fact of the relationships, or is there something else that do you think is driving their willingness to engage with this industry?
It's a good question. I think part of it is just that these lobbyists are so much part of the ecosystem of Parliament. And I worked there for 15 years in the Parliamentary Press Gallery. And somewhat to my shame, never did these kinds of stories on this industry. And I think it's a bit like that, you know, fish and water parable. The fish doesn't realise it's swimming in water. These guys are part of the ecosystem. They're people you know, people you often like, people who used to be journalists. And this revolving door that we talk about, and I'm sure we'll probably talk a bit more about this, it spins around so fast that these people are coming and going from these kinds of roles, from government to lobbying, sometimes back again. They're just seen as another player in this scheme. And sometimes they'll be, what you also find is there's trades that are going on. They're not explicit, but they're like, lobbyists will text a minister, say, hey, I've got something for you. Now, I don't know what that was because the text runs dry or it's been redacted. I've seen evidence that they've been helping them with parliamentary questions, which I find pretty interesting too. Again, those are heavily redacted. So there's an information sharing thing going on here. They're part of the ecosystem. I can get this for you. I'll give you a heads up on that. And so, yeah, I don't think it's, I've got no evidence that there's corruption, that they're being paid off or anything silly like that. And I agree with your assessment about the beer or the free meal. But I think that they're seen as traitors in the scheme.
Right. I mean, the story you ran on Tuesday about Andrew Curtin, who, you know, was lobbying for Asahi and Lion, you know, on things like the container recycling scheme, and I assume had an opinion on the alcohol sponsorship of sports, and moved into government the following day, you know, to become chief of staff of the new prime minister. And within a couple of weeks, those policies were scrapped. Seems like something that should, you know, that should cause any government, particularly like a Labour government, which had until recently really positioned those as kind of moral issues, whether it's climate change or, you know, the kind of broader health of society. And yet there doesn't seem to have been. You know, I've listened to Kim's extraordinary interview, I thought, with Hipkins this week. You just couldn't seem to kind of conjure a sense of, you know, not necessarily even shame, but any kind of introspection or disquiet about it.
I think they are banking on the idea that this is an issue that won't touch the general public, that it's all about the cost of living, and that people in, you know, the shopping malls of New Zealand aren't going to care about lobbyists and cool-off periods and that sort of thing. And they're probably right to a degree that it might not be an issue that has excites popular attention. But I think it should. And I think that this is a major gap in our democracy. And we have a proud democracy and a very strong one. I think this is a major gap. And it's not just an opinion. When you look at the OECD report into lobbying, which was done in 2021, we're out of 41 countries, we're one of 9 that has no revolving door policy at all. You can go straight from government to lobbying or the other way around. We're utterly unregulated. And all the countries that we compare ourselves to in terms of strong developed democracies have regulated rules for lobbying. We don't even define what it is. We don't know who the clients are. You've now got a chief of staff for the Prime Minister who's one day cold from a lobbying firm. Who are his clients? Well, if you want to file 70 OAAs, you might be able to find out a few of them. That's what we did. But who are they?
It's quite extraordinary, right? Because, I mean, one of the things that I noticed was that Draper Cormac, which is another of the firms involved, you know, Pharmac, who, you know, given the scale of them and the importance of the work they do, must be one of their biggest clients, and yet their name was not on their website, which is sort of, you know, part of the function of it is to crow about who you've got on the books. You know, you've got to assume that that's because Pharmac doesn't want to be there, or you know, maybe the firm doesn't want them. But yeah, you know, you'd think it would just be an absolute precondition of engagement if you are a government entity or agency to say, we should, you know, the public should know who we're engaging and why. And yet it seems like the reverse. The private sector, you know, because a lot of those entities was more comfortable with people knowing whose services they were procuring than the public. I mean, which brings a kind of a bigger point, maybe speak to that narrowly, but also the broader one of, do you believe that, you know, having really pored over the sum, you've got to shrink it a bit to report it in some respects, that the public interest was broadly served by these engagements?
Well, I think that is the central question. And so that's why I looked at one specific story on public agencies using these kinds of services. What public interest is served by Pharmac using a firm like this? I mean, I can really understand Pharmac needing communication staff, quite a few of them, to explain how some particular drug might impact on a various sector group or why it made a particular decision, because these are complex things with massive stakes and big money at stake. But does that include getting the CEO to stage an exit from a select committee to avoid the media? Does that include trying to get Sarah Fitt into women's magazines, for example? I mean, this seems more about brand protection for CEOs or chairs or senior executive staff. That is not serving the public interest at all. I don't even think it's serving Pharmac's interest as an ongoing proud independent entity which relies on objectivity and science. How is that doing that?
It's almost about Sarah Flett's next job.
It's protecting her brand.
Yeah.
And they're using our money to do that. So I think that's highly questionable. The same with Transpower. It's a monopoly SOE, for God's sake, running the national grid. Why are they gathering political intelligence on MPs and trying to find out where their vulnerabilities and whether they failed in medical school or not? I mean, they might not be enormous sums, but is that really in the public interest to be doing?
Yeah, absolutely. Or, you know, given, you know, Transpower has 9 communication staff, I do think it's important to note, and I really believe this, that the communications environment that we operate in now is vastly different from the one that, you know, existed when you or I first entered journalism. But fundamentally, like, I think that there is this kind of mission creep of communications more broadly into to the point where it sort of can feel like it's eating the world, like it sort of swims downstream into organisations, so that every decision, and you know, we talked earlier off air about the way that no surprises that policy interacts with this, but that is triangulated through the lens of communications, which I think can actually be profoundly corrosive. I mean, you've been in the gallery. You've been in politics and journalism for you know, 3 decades now. Is there something that you have observed over the course of your career has evolved over time, the sort of that interaction between communications and the state itself?
Oh, massively. And I think you've hit on a couple of key points there. I came into the press gallery in 1998, and I remember back in those days when I was working for the Evening Post, you'd ring someone in an outfit called CC Mao, which was a branch of Treasury which looked after SOEs, and I don't think that they divided up like that anymore. But I remember ringing a guy from Treasury, effectively, and asking him about Radio New Zealand's future. I was reporting about it at the time, and he gave me this interview. He was sort of an official. We did a story on it, which was quite controversial at the time. But, you know, in those days you could ring... You could ring people who are experts in their area who would give interviews. And in the early Helen Clark years, in the early 2000s, they developed the no surprises rule, which is quite insidious and I think has had a major impact on this, because it's I can understand if it's going to be a two-hoy raids from the police, you could imagine you would 24 hours, 6 hours heads up about this massive thing that was going to happen. I get that on major issues. But it hasn't become a no surprises rule. It's become a no embarrassment rule. And so every OIA goes back to the minister's office to see whether there's anything that's embarrassing to the minister. And our public service, that's not their role. You know, their role isn't, again, we talked about brand management of CEOs. This is brand management of politicians. There's no public interest there. And I think that allows for massive mission creep for these lobbying firms and PR agencies, government relations firms, whatever you want to call them, to go in and basically try to avoid any embarrassment or political fallout for ministers.
Let's talk a bit more about no surprises, because I do agree that it does feel like it is in conflict with the sort of mission and function and ultimately the you know, part of the reason you're able to levy taxes and impose laws and put people in prison is because of the relationship between, you know, the citizenry and those who sort of govern and rule them. And when, you know, no surprises doesn't seem to always sit particularly easily with that kind of implied compact. You know, can you just talk a bit more about what no surprises really is? It's because it's not a law, right? It's a vibe in some respects.
Yeah, and there are references to it in the cabinet manual, but a vibe is probably not a bad way to put it. It's a convention. There was a big argument, wasn't there, about whether tipping off ministers to Winston Peters' superannuation overpayment should have fell under that policy, and that went right through the court. So there's, you know, there is increasing analysis of this, but effectively, in simple terms, it just means I don't want to read about this first on the spin-off or on RNZ or Stuff. I want you to tell me first, and if you do, I might be able to find a way not to make it public, and that's not healthy.
Do you have any confidence in change? Like, has any party reacted to this in a way where you go, well, obviously Labour, currently in government, are not, I assume, not loving it. But do you have a sense that there might be enough of a groundswell that might get us some laws that would bring us closer to the median of the OECD, potentially?
I can see that the door is open to crack, it's open to jar, if you like, which is good. Chris Hipkins is saying he won't rule out changes to lobbying, which isn't amazing, but to lobbying regulation. And National's probably a little more eager, as you could imagine, in opposition, and they have been very critical of the revolving door speed and the lack of any regulation around that. So there seems to be some appetite there. The last attempt was in 2012. Sue Kedgley had a bill, and then it was taken over by Holly Walker from the Green Party. The Green Party aren't exempt from this too. You might remember Tori Whānau. She was the Chief of Staff for the Green Party. She resigned from that job as Chief of Staff, went to Capital Government Relations, Neil Jones's firm. She worked with them right up until the day she was elected mayor. Right?
That's pretty extraordinary.
Right up until the day she was elected mayor.
So you can imagine she's out there campaigning.
Yeah.
While also, you know, performing or you know, working on behalf of clients. Who knew that polling was said that she was most likely next mayor of Wellington?
Yeah, and all that. And again, all of the stuff comes back to transparency. There'd be no real problem if there was just a register and naming the people would go a long, long way. I mean, one of the ironies to me is that because some of these New Zealand companies are big enough, they have lobbyists in Australia, right? So Air New Zealand has lobbyists working for them in Australia. Now, I can go online, look right now, I type in Air New Zealand to the lobbying register in Australia, run by the Attorney General's office, and it comes up with a firm called Diplomacy, and there's a couple of names, I can't remember the names of these guys, who work for Air New Zealand as lobbyists in Australia. So I know them, but I've got no idea who lobbies for them in New Zealand. I mean, you might know, someone might know, might have told so-and-so, but there's no public register of it. And this doubles down because many of these people are commentators and high-profile commentators in our media landscape, massively high-profile commentators. And, you know, again, if you knew who they were working for, then I'm not saying they shouldn't be commentators. I just think that if the public knew who they were working for, or you could find out who they were working for, I think you'd be able to make a better judgment about how to take what they were saying. So it all comes back to transparency.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I was going to ask you about the commentators then, because, you know, people like Neil Jones, Matthew Hooden has done this work. I mean, these are some of the most prominent. They're really good commentators, you know. So like they as you, in some respects, you would expect, given the degree, you know, the jobs they've worked in, and the degree of access and so on. But, and honestly, I, you know, maybe I'm naive. I don't necessarily think that they are aggressively pushing for a particular client's agenda in their commentary. But there is just something that's kind of, you know, it surprises you because they are ubiquitous. Like, we all use them in various capacities, and yet, there is something that is quite unsettling.
Well, there is. And look, you know, let's be honest, these guys are very good at it. They have expert knowledge. A lot of them are very good people. And I tend to agree with you that they most likely do have integrity in that respect. But that's not enough. You know, there's the old saying, you know, trust, but then verify. And we need to be able to do that. Is it good enough to say, oh, yeah, well, he's a good guy, so it's probably fine?
It's a very New Zealand
kind of approach. And this whole story is a very New Zealand way of looking at things. Oh, well, you know, yeah, no, he's a good guy. I used to work with him. Mm. There's no problem here. Oh, lobbying, and their mind goes immediately to Washington and doesn't think of Wellington at all. Oh, you go look at the US lobbying law, and it's incredibly robust and rigorous. They have transparency. They have laws. If you breach the code of conduct and breach the law for lobbying in the US, you can get locked up. They have revolving door policies. They have disclosure. Canada has a commissioner for lobbying. All of these OECD countries have this call-off period and register so you know who these people are working for. In New Zealand, there's no regulation at all. I mean, real estate agents, for God's sake, have to be disclosed. Lawyers have a register where you can find out who's been struck off from some suburban law firm. Yet these people are right at the heart of decision-making, lobbying on massive issues with huge money at stake, and yet we've got no regulation at all. I mean, it doesn't really seem that there's a strong case to defend that.
The Fold is brought to you by oMedia, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa, with over 4,000 out-of-home advertising sites nationwide across both street furniture and retail centres. I'm super grateful to oMedia for enabling us to make unmissable connections with Kiwis.
Talo for Lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spin-Off. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spin-Off member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
I do want to kind of move into other aspects of your career as well. I was wondering if you could talk about, you know, your sort of, because I first encountered your work as a print journalist, and you know, I wondered what drew you into print, and then what moved you away from it.
Yeah, so I spent the first 10 years of my journalism career as a print newspaper journalist, for various little publications until the Evening Post, my first real daily job in journalism, and then into the gallery for them in the late 90s. And I moved from there to the Sunday Star Times and spent a stint as political editor there before Mark Sainsbury dragged me into television at a time in my life where things had changed. There was, you know, I'd had personal change in my life and also was thinking about the future of newspapers and thought I'd give this a crack. So he dragged me into television and I spent, you know, 10 years there, largely for TVNZ in the political realm, but then on to TV3 in my later years of that. And then into radio. So, yeah, I've if you're going to spend an entire career in journalism and storytelling, which I intend to do, I made a decision a few years ago that I wouldn't be a manager. I'm not a good manager. I'm a content guy. I'm a storyteller, and that's what I'm going to do until I'm dragged out in a box. So, if you're going to do that, there's a long time. You want to play in the different codes. If it's to use a sporting analogy, I suppose, don't you? And, you know, so you want to do interviewing and you want to do documentary making and you want to do podcasts and you want to write. You want to keep yourself interested and give yourself new challenges. And put a book out this year. I hadn't done that really before. So what's next, and how do I keep this interesting, and how do I keep not reinventing myself, but something close to that?
It's interesting because, like, I remember when you were political editor of the Sunday Star Times and reading your analysis, and it had this, it felt like you introduced a bit of a new style to the political analysis thing. What, to me, it said that there was this kind of coolly rational quality to it, which I really enjoyed and felt like it was a bit of a change from the more established style of the kind of probably an older generation of political editors. What sort of informed the way that you approached being in the gallery? Because there is a sort of there's a lot of different ways that you can approach it. And yeah, we've got, I think, a fantastic gallery at the moment. And you can move from anything from, like, TV3 has a particular kind of energy to the way it approaches things. But I also love the way that, like, say, like a Henry Cook or a Thomas Coughlin, that they seem to be almost heirs of yours, and that sort of, well, here is a way of understanding this thing, and that is quite, it's a little bit more dispassionate, which I think actually benefits the material. So, yeah, do you want to just talk about that sort of whole stylistic tonal piece?
Yeah, and I think that those names you mentioned, I read those people and think, wow, this is great, and this is so good to see people coming through doing that. Yeah, I suppose when you were writing for the Sunday Star Times back in those days, you were expecting and relying on people spending quite a bit of time to read this 1,000-plus-word column that you'd wrote, and without polarizing people, I think we, and not those names you've mentioned, that because there are many good people, but we both here in New Zealand and overseas have tended to go down this, you know, ferment the outrage sort of style, where you're wanting to emote and to drive sort of a polarization, and I don't think that that's been terribly healthy. I think you get so much more out of it when you do get someone unpacking how something actually works, and actually making people think, and actually relying on the writing. I mean, tried to do that style where you actually are putting a lot of care into the writing itself and the allusions that you're making and those sorts of things. And so, yeah, I've kept some of those clippings and look back, and it does look a little old fashioned now. But yeah, it's nice to see others coming through with at least, you know, I guess, picking up the baton in some respects.
So you worked at TVNZ through probably its last great apex in terms of the true power of the state broadcaster at a time when it had far less competition for attention. What are your kind of memories of that era? And I guess when I'm thinking about the sort of the true scale impact of a story that, you know, that could be broken or picked up and run with by an organisation in that era versus now, when, you know, there can be big stories that people who can still be paying a lot of attention to media but can be completely oblivious to because of the fact that everyone has a truly unique media diet nowadays.
Yeah, I think it's a very good point. I remember when I came over to television for TV One in the press gallery, the attention that the politicians paid, especially to TV One, was frightening because their voters all watched TV One. TV Three used to beat us quite a lot on politics. You know, Duncan Garner was a formidable opponent, and often they'd kick our ass. But it was what the politicians wanted to know, what was on TV One, and you would literally feel the world blowing up when you did something controversial on TV One. A story that came to mind when you were saying that and asking me that question was Michael Cullen, who had an utter tirade at me during an interview, or even a setup to an interview. It was quite controversial that we played it, and I'm not even sure in hindsight that we did the right thing. But we aired this tantrum that he had about tax cuts.
When you say the setup, you mean so this is the preamble? Yeah. You were rolling, but he didn't necessarily know that.
Yes. Yeah.
It was going to be for broadcast. Yep. So carry on. Yep.
We won a BSA on it, but in hindsight, I don't know. It was a bit 50-50, I think. But anyway, we ran it, and Mike Jaspers, who's one of the lobbyists now, I still remember, you know, absolute inferno down the line at this thing as it went to air. And I was put into Siberia by that Labor government for many months after that. They would leak stories that we'd communicated with them onto a competition. They would not talk to you in the lifts. And I still remember Parikura Horomia saying to me in the lift, he said, "I still love you. I still love you, Guyan." And I still remember that because it was really, we were locked out because we'd blown them up, and it was damaging. This was their number two guy, and we'd taken out their number two. Like he'd utterly made a fool of himself. And I have massive respect for the late Sir Michael Cullen, but he'd gone quite porungy on this thing, and he'd just really blown up his reputation. But the impact of a big story broken on TV One was huge. And I remember the same with Bill English's housing allowance in the early days of the Key government. This would be circa 2009. The Herald had done a lot of work on the story too, but Bill English was claiming something close to 50 grand for a housing allowance, and did he live in Dipton or did he live in Wellington? And this was a big deal in the GFC because it was austerity measures coming in. And the guy, I remember him ringing me up on the phone, effing and blinding, literally effing and blinding, because we'd run the story on TV One. And that was the impact that it had. So it was high stakes.
It's interesting, right? Because I did a story last year about Corngate, which was, you know, part of me, when you were talking about No Surprise before, was wondering about what the extent to which it might even be traceable to a moment like that. But, you know, John Campbell described, you know, when I was reporting that, a very similar situation in which, out the back of it, he felt like he and to a lesser extent Three were basically just frozen out by Clark because he'd sort of broken one of these unwritten rules of engagement between the organisations.
Absolutely. She called him a little creep, didn't she, from memory? I bet the sports media have a similar issue with the All Blacks, and I don't know because I've never been a sports reporter and no one would read my sports reporting if I was. But if I had my time again, and this really does signal back to the lobbying thing too, I think I would be more aggressively independent. You know, I'd like to think I would be. And access journalism, as they call it, is never worth it. You know, I really do subscribe to that theory that news is something that someone somewhere does not want you to know, and all the rest is advertising. And I think that there's a sort of philosophy that you need to carry into that job to serve the public well. Because if you're relying on getting the tips and getting the next heads up on a story, that's not a yarn. That's not something you're going to look back with pride because you got the next ambassador to London 6 hours before. Your boss will be happy. See, that's the way the circle works. Public and listening to this may not know that. That's, you know, so you're a gallery journalist and your good mate and the advisor, as an advisor in the office, tells you, oh yeah, so-and-so's going to be the next ambassador to London, and you get the story first. And so, you know, and it's exclusive and your boss is happy and you're happy, but what have you really done? You know, so, and when you do a story like Corngate or you blow up Michael Cullen on tax or whatever, then, and they lock you out, well, they're locking you out because you told someone something they didn't want you to know. So that whole relationship stuff is difficult to navigate as a gallery journalist. And I've quite enjoyed doing things like this lobbying series and the New Zealand First Foundation, stuff like that from Auckland, where you're not in there. And sometimes some of that, distance can actually be quite empowering.
Have you just quickly returned to that lobbying story? You know, obviously the lobbyists won't have liked being front and centre of it. Have you had any kind of blowback in a similar style?
Yeah, I have. I have. And in fact, a lot of them are ringing me now and saying, oh, you're looking in the wrong place. So-and-so is far more powerful than we are. And in some cases, they're actually right.
Would you say you're being lobbied?
Pretty much. And the lobbyists killed the previous bill. But they are right in respect of saying that the public law category of this is an area where they have a lot of power, and I haven't looked at that, but I'm quite keen to.
So you moved from TVNZ to, well, you had a brief stint at 3. I actually want to talk about one of the shows you did there because I still miss it. But from there you went to RNZ. So you've had long relationships with and key roles at the two state owned media organisations, or two of the state-owned media organisations, the two most prominent. Were you? I'm going to ask you about the merger. Did you have a position on it? And you know what do you sort of make of the fundamental driver of it? That is basically that those organisations, just like a lot of the legacy media, aren't meeting the needs of younger or more diverse New Zealand as well.
Yeah, two positions, I suppose. From a personal perspective about me, I wanted and was excited about it because I wanted to get my hands on the kit. You know, I mean, I love making television. We've made some documentaries, Proof and then Wasted, which screened on primetime. We're very proud of them. We made them, just two of us, with literally a few thousand dollars. I mean, you know, on extraordinary, the smell of an oily rag. We really did. And so I was really looking forward to getting in and using those studios and working with some of the great people and the great equipment at TVNZ. And I also love interviewing, and I love television interviewing, because it's different. And, you know, I did Q&A for many years, and I'd love to come back to do more of that stuff. So I was excited about that. So that's my personal position. In terms of a public policy position, I could never quite work out why they felt that this was the answer to the problem that they had perceived. I mean, as good as they could get was, well, we're facing an information democracy disinformation crisis and a supercharged merged media company may have the ballast and the robustness to get us through that. But I would have thought that both of those things could have been done by strengthening the individual entities rather than merging them together. I mean, in really shorthand terms, and this will probably upset my employer and the other guys as well, RNZ is probably a little bit too worthy and doesn't quite meet the needs of these diverse audiences. TVNZ is probably a little bit too shallow at times and doesn't do quite enough on that on the journalism culture, or having possibly enough quality local stuff. So you could have tweaked either of them, and we may well see that without merging them together. I mean, if you've got deficiencies in two people, have they been solved by getting them married? I haven't seen that necessarily being a solution, and I don't know that it really was. And in the end, it fell apart because they couldn't argue for it because they didn't really know why they wanted to do it. And that was the hill that it died on, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, one of the things that I think makes this more difficult, is that to truly do a digital transformation of any organisation, let alone a media organisation, you can't keep doing everything you used to do and like doing and do everything else. There is, at a certain point, you have to make hard decisions about the things that you previously had done, much as you love them, that they might have to, that resource might need to be put somewhere else. The thing that I think, you know, RNZ's, you know, which I probably agree with your assessment of your own employer, which I think you're brave to make, you know, is that it actually is hamstrung in its ability to make those kind of moves because of the politics with it. And you saw that most acutely around the RNZ concert debacle. You know, is what do you feel like the organisation has a mismatch between its what it would like to do and what it is politically able to do, or could it try harder, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to see some interesting times ahead because the government is committed to spending some more money on RNZ. It'll be fascinating to see how that is used because there are a lot of things they want to do that they simply can't do. And that goes right from the technology of the place and the quality of the equipment through to programming and audiences that aren't as well served as we would like to do. But yeah, it's very difficult, isn't it, for media organisations because they look at their audience and often they are older people. I mean, even people older than 50, and they're like, oh, we want to attract the younger, browner ones, and look, you know, we need to do this sort of stuff. But if that is done at the expense of cutting off your existing audience, then that's problematic. So, yeah, I mean, my own view, and look, you know, we're straying into management territory, which I told you earlier, if you keep that bit in, that I'm not a manager, I don't have to make those decisions, and it's probably a good thing that I don't. But what I would say more broadly on that is, and again, it's a bit like politics, if you're driven by polls or numbers, you tend to make decisions that aren't authentic. And I reckon that if you make good, authentic stuff and you make cool stuff, then people are going to get into it, even younger people. I mean, I see young people, I've got mates whose teenagers are listening to true crime podcasts, and it's cool, you know, and they're 16 or 17. So, you know, don't think that younger people, for example, will only get it if you're going to do, it has to be a hip-hop style doco or whatever. It doesn't have to be. Like, you can engage people in cool stuff. I bet there are young people who are into the lobbying series because they're interested in lobbying. They've seen Thank You for Smoking or whatever. They're into it. How are we going to engage this audience? It doesn't have to be by, you know, by talking down to them. I think it's just being authentic and trying to drive cool stuff. But as I say, this is probably a good example of why no one's asked me to be the chief executive.
Fair enough. Well, so let's move back to content because there are a couple of, you know, guy on Espinner joints, if you will, if that's not too embarrassing of a way to put it, that I want to just end by talking about because they're both very different, but seem to me just quite original approaches to very different sort of issues. The first is the vote, which you know, I'd be curious about your role in that, your memories of it. So this was a show for TV3, it was you and Duncan Garner, and it was like very explicitly, let's try and make this about issues, but make it kind of pop and in prime time. And it felt to me, and there are a number of like vote heads that I know who have really fond memories of that show. Talk about its genesis and why you think it didn't get to kind of fly on the way it might have.
I'd love to, because I've got fond memories of that too. Duncan Garner and I bodged that show up on the back of a napkin in Galbraith's pub and came up with the idea ourselves. I remember talking to Bailey Mackey about it, and he was horrified that we hadn't done some legal thing with the IP or whatever, because that's where his mind went to. He's a very, very successful commercial guy. And Duncan and I are not. We're journos. But we came up with the idea, and exactly like you say, so we had this idea where you would have to come up with, you'd have a moot, have an argument, you know, is New Zealand a racist country was one of our things, well before Taika created his controversy with it. And you'd have two different teams and you'd cross-examine them. So it was part courtroom drama, part sort of debating society, and then you'd have, you know, Bob Jones and Lila Hare and these people. And you'd have it in front of a live audience, and then the last 10 or 15 minutes of the show was done and live from Flower Street, where you'd have the votes coming in on Twitter and the apps and stuff. So this was like 2012.
It was early.
Yeah.
For a show of this nature.
And so it was a bit of everything, and quite unique. Now, it got canned on numbers that they would kill for today. Utterly. You know, these were pretty good numbers. I remember we used to come on after Ice Road Truckers, and he'd take
it's
a bit of a
in.
Dip. He's good leading. And it'd take a bit of a dip, but we did pretty well for what on the face of it is a worthy thing, right? But it was primetime TV on commercial television, and the numbers were pretty good. And I'm still a bit pissed off at TV3 for canning it, because New Zealand On Air were largely paying for it as well. And I think that format could have been, you know, could have been pretty good, especially, you know, in election years and stuff. So yeah, it was a really cool idea, and it was full on to do. Gosh, it was probably the hardest TV I'd ever done, because you had to do it in front of a live audience, in front of an audience of real humans, and then switch over to the studio to when the votes came in. But yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where the you can imagine. Had the merger gone ahead, it's got clear public interest, but it is seeking to do what can be done in a very dry, off way, away from peak style, something that will connect with an audience that has previously been watching Ice Road Truckers. And that's the thing where I was like, this is gorgeous. Yeah. Like, this is what we should all be shooting for. So no, agree that it's a shame. Now the other one to talk about, totally different, much more worthy in some respects, but I absolutely devoured it, was The Ninth Floor. And again, like that felt like something that you were deeply passionate about, a really kind of singular piece of work and framing. But yeah, I just wondered if you could talk about where that came from, and also about whether there has been any discussion about, because there is now a few different former prime ministers, all of whom would be fascinating to join that series. Yeah, what's
utterly.
Your...
Firstly, it was Tim Watkins' idea, who I worked on it with, and he looked at this thing. There was a book which I've still got on my shelf at home called The President's Club, which I didn't know about. It was a sort of a club that US, former US presidents meet and talk and support each other. It's sort of like a AA for former presidents, I suppose. And he got the idea from there, and Carol Hirschfeld, who was head of news at TVNZ at RNZ at the time, said, "Oh, why don't you take a couple of weeks off from Morning Report and do a podcast?" And I was looking around, I was thinking, "Oh, I do want an immigration policy or something." And then I was talking to Tim, and he said, "No, why don't we do this?" And so I thought, "Yeah, great." And we got into it and absolutely loved it. And just to intersect with a couple of things we've already talked about, I expected that to be of interest to a few people in sort of libraries and a few, you know, political heads. The reaction to that was extraordinary. I remember getting on a bus on Dominion Road and being hit up by people in the street, by young people slouching along with backpacks saying, "Bro, watch The Ninth Floor. It was so cool." And I thought, wow, that is just, and that's the sort of feedback as a journalist you absolutely love, because you know you've touched people. And the idea that they were really into the fact, because they didn't know, they're like, "Oh, so you weren't allowed to shop on a Saturday in New Zealand?" It's like, this is what happened. Or, you know, the sort of stuff that it just reintroducing people to some of the history and trying to give them a map to where we got now, because we're really poor at doing this in New Zealand. And so it was really cool to see people, ordinary people, engage with it.
I mean, I think also by bundling everyone you could get, you sort of realised, I think it had this beautiful thing where it kind of really diffused some of the instinctive tribalism I think people have, because you got the sense of the stakes and the various forces acting on these people as prime ministers, that it wasn't just as simple as I think people make out. And I think that texture and the, you know, I'm not saying that politics is all noble by any means, but there was a sort of a nobility toward the act of governing that came through in those threads, and that I think had a real, you know, certainly for me as a listening, kind of it crystallised a quite a beautiful thing about New Zealand politics, which does seem different.
It's really interesting that you raise that, and I was just thinking as you were framing that question that if we were even to do that today, I mean, I proudly tweeted all those out on Twitter. I don't think I could do that now.
Because of the partisan audience reaction.
Yeah. I largely gave up Twitter after I did the Christopher Luxon profile on RNZ, and I spent a couple of 6 weeks and did what I was quite proud of as an interesting profile on this guy who could be prime minister and is the leader of the opposition. And I just got utterly smashed by morons on Twitter, and I just thought, this is just, I can't deal with this. So I do get on it every now and again, largely to promote my work and use it in that way, but I don't engage with anyone. But you're utterly right about that lack of partisanship. You know, like Jenny Shipley isn't an evil person who wanted to cut benefits. She, whether that was right or wrong, you can test that through your own, you know, engagement with her. But, you know, the BNZ crisis and the Bulger government and all that, you can assess that. So if you treat, and that was one bottom line, we were going to treat them all the same and look at why they did what they did and give them the space to explain that and the historical context and the forces that they were dealing with. And I don't think we have as many vehicles as I would like to be able to do that today. You also asked about whether we would do others, and I have wanted to do that. And we also had an idea that I'll put out here, I probably shouldn't, but of doing the seventh floor, which is the finance ministers, and got quite a long way ahead with it, but money and time, we haven't started that. But again, you know, Douglas and Richardson, and should have got Cullen when he was alive. But, you know, that's a project that I'd wanted to do. And, you know, also sitting there now are Bill English and John Key and Jacinda Ardern. So hopefully we can add some chapters to that in the years ahead.
Speaking very selfishly, I would love that. Finally, two projects which feel both sort of personal to you, but also in some respects speak to, you know, you always wonder, allow me this digression, what are the things that are hiding in plain sight in your current era that future generations will look back on and go, what the hell were they up to with that? And there have been so many things about whether it's homosexual law reform or, you know, all kinds of various quite racist policies that we now are aghast at. And I feel like in these two documentaries, Proof and Wasted, you assess the relationship with our big legal drug that is, you know, so embedded in our society and Wasted, the sort of war on drugs, you know, on the flip side, as being something which absolutely it doesn't feel morally defensible to these two treatments, and it doesn't seem like something that will abide forever, because it just, most of these things eventually get worn down by time and fresh eyes. But yeah, so just tell me about those projects and why you were drawn to them.
Well, you actually touched on it in that question, and it is something that I'm drawn to, things that hide in plain sight. There's a lovely phrase the Washington Press Corps has where they say, don't worry about what's illegal. Look at what's legal, because that's the test that society is going to accept. And I think a lot of people go into investigative journalism thinking, I'm going to find the corruption illegal thing happening over here. I've been drawn in recent years to what we have and what we accept legally. I recently did Lotto and had a look at how that works and how you can buy Lotto tickets as a child and how the whole...
We just did a fundraiser for a cyclone using Lotto.
Without irony. I saw that the other day, without irony, and it doesn't matter. You can't tell people.
It wasn't even particularly controversial.
No.
Government saying, hey, buy some...
No.
Wow.
And we spend $1.5 billion on Lotto a year, and we give $300 million of that to charity, and everyone thinks it's amazing. Amazing. It's like, it's quite incredible to me. So I love unpicking stuff that are hiding in plain sight. And the alcohol one is one of those big ones that literally hides in plain sight. And what I like doing with the alcohol argument is you take the, you know, what the most harmful drugs are in terms of science. And it's well known now that alcohol is at the top of the list by any respected scientist you'll name. Professor Nutt's the most famous one from 2010, British guy. People can Google that. They'll probably know who I'm talking about. Who said that in terms of the damage to the user and society, alcohol is the most dangerous drug we have, and listed all the others. He got fired for it because he said alcohol was more dangerous than E, but of course it was. If you swap out any of those drugs for alcohol, you get into an absurd situation where you've got the most dangerous drug sponsoring this kids' sports team, and you've got the one at the bottom of the scale, like Magic Mushrooms, which you can go to jail for life for selling. So, you know, it doesn't make any rational or logical sense. Yet that argument that I've just espoused is seen to be a radical fringe argument. Oh, my God, he wants magic mushrooms to be consumed or legal. That's a freak, you know. But if you look at it, the science of it, which we're all urged to do nowadays, follow the science, evidence-based, that just simply does not stack up. And so it's quite good to just go, why do we think like that? What are the forces that have made us think like that? What are the cultural forces, the regulation, the advertising, the promotion and all that stuff? So it really did draw me to that alcohol. And then it seemed like the next logical place to go was how we treat the other drugs. And so that's why we did Wasted after doing Proof.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating topic. And again, one which I think the media were very complicit in. You talked about right at the start about the different styles of political columnists, and there was all, you know, if anyone attempted to touch a subject like that, there would be this kind of default outrage. Whereas now I think because of our exposure to the world where there has been a lot more reform, there is just a lot less of a, I think that the electorate might be ahead of politics, which is very rare on this one.
Yeah, I think that might be true. Politicians always seem to think that they're going to get utterly smashed on this stuff. And then when it happens, people just shrug their shoulders. A classic case was gay marriage. You know, Helen Clark had fought incredibly hard to get the civil unions through. John Key looked around at Obama, who'd done it in America, and went, oh, okay, we're on board with this. And suddenly the Conservative National Party was like for gay marriage, and everyone had thought, oh, they'll never do that. And then it was like, oh, this is the way to go.
Totally. Well, yeah, I mean, and I think that's where the sort of, politics and media, they interact and might be seen as kind of fixed and immovable. They're actually moving very, very quickly. And I think your work over the years has certainly kind of illuminated some of that. Thank you so much for coming on The Fold. It's been such a fascinating chat.
I've really enjoyed the chat, and thanks for the opportunity, Duncan. Appreciate it.
That was The Fold, brought to you by our partners at oMedia, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa. Huge thanks to oMedia for sponsoring this episode of The Fold and enabling us to make unmissable connections with Kiwis.
Kia ora e te iwi, Te Aihe Butler here, podcast manager at The Spinoff. If you enjoy listening to our podcasts, consider supporting our mahi by signing up to become a Spinoff member at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spinoff Podcast Network.